Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, Steele, how you doing?
Dave, I'm doing tremendous. I'm really excited today because my best friend from graduate school is here with us.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. His name is Eric.
Hey, Dave. Hey, Steele.
Hello, Eric. You know, Eric hails from Starkville, Mississippi now, but he's in town in Madison and agreed to come on the show. So we're very excited to have you, Eric.
I'm very excited to be here.
I'm excited you're here, Eric. I think we've been in the same room at least once before. I'm excited to actually have a conversation this time.
Well, guys, we have a lot to cover today. We're going to talk about some life hacks up at the top. We've got a section of small talk. We've also got expert testimony, Mississippi Buffalo Bills edition. We've got a special segment of Off the Chain Authors. And then, as always, we're going to end up with Unchained Melodies and Book Wisdom. And this episode, I have to say, it's going to have something of a distinctly Southern flavor. We don't represent the Southern states in the United States very much. But now that we have an authentic Southern resident.
Okay. That's good. I am authentically a Southern resident. I have a Mississippi driver's license, and if there's time, nice. I can tell you that story, although that would probably take about half an hour.
Sweet.
Steele, are you aware that I was born in Alabama? I've got a Southern soul, so I'm ready to talk about it.
Nice. Which city, Dave?
Mobile.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Yeah, just not too far off the Gulf Coast. Wonderful place. I haven't been back since I was 3, but I think it's a good place.
So, life hacks. I wanted us each, I thought this would be a good way to start the episode today. Something that you have discovered recently that has changed your life for the better.
So, I had a hard time thinking of these, and all mine are kind of stupid. But here's one that I really enjoy. Using a headlamp to read in bed. I hate to reach up, turn the lamp off. You don't want to get out of bed to turn the light off. I just have a headlamp on my head, reading the book. When I'm sleepy, I can just kind of slip it off and go off into slumber.
So do you just turn the lamp off and fall asleep with the headlamp still attached, or do you actually remove the headlamp?
It doesn't matter. Either way.
Is this a spelunking headlamp? Does it come with a helmet? Or is it more like the optometrist light that's kind of sticking out from the center of your forehead?
This would be one that you would use for spelunking. You just don't use the helmet while you're reading in bed. I would recommend against using the helmet. You just have it right there. It's perfectly set on your page. If there's a partner in your bed sleeping, you're not going to disturb them because it's just a headlamp.
But if you look from side to side, then it causes problems. So you got to stay focused on your book.
Yeah. And if somehow, for some reason, it turns into a dance party in your bedroom, you got the light, things, it gets really fun.
I imagine in my bedroom, if you looked side to side and the lamp moved, the cats would go crazy. They'd be chasing this thing all over the place. It'd be chaos.
Well, that's another element of fun that you could have.
That's great. So a headlamp for reading in bed. We'll have to put up a brand recommendation on the website, Dave, when we finish the episode.
All right. Well, my life hack is Google Flights, which you can either Google the phrase Google Flights. I think you can probably just Google Flights. But Google has put together the flight search engine that I've always wanted, which is you can put in 4 different cities. Let's say you live in an airport desert like I do now in Mississippi, where there's a very small regional airport that's very expensive to fly in and out of. And so the odds are pretty good that you're going to have to drive. But the airports are 3 or 4 hours in any direction.
So it doesn't matter which one, but you have to plan for it.
But you have to plan for it. And so Google Flights will allow you to plug in 4 different cities. They don't have to be all connected. Like with Expedia, you can plug in Washington, D.C. airports, right? But here you can do airports that are, you know, 250 miles apart. And it will tell you the cheapest route to fly. And then you can play with the calendar and say, I want to go on a 4-day trip between these 2 places in the month of December. What's the cheapest 4-day period? And it'll tell you that. I mean, there are all of these different analytic tools that you can use, and Google compiles all these different websites. Now, you can't actually buy the tickets from Google, but they will give you a link to how to buy that cheap flight. A colleague of mine told me about it, and it's changed the way I've searched for airfare.
So are you flying more often now that you have it, or are you just flying more happily because you're paying less money?
I'm actually driving more often because I didn't discover it until I moved to an airport desert. And now I realize that if I have to drive 5 hours in the wrong direction, for example, I had to go to Dallas in February, and the cheapest way to do this was to fly from Atlanta, which is 5 hours to my east, to Dallas, which is 8 hours to my west. And so I just drove the 8 hours. This is my life now. But for those people who do have to fly regularly, Google Flights, I give it a sincere thumbs up.
That's great. So I've got a sincere thumb up from another Google product. This has turned into the Google sponsored radio show. So is there a Google headlamp, Dave, that you want to recommend? We want to revise that.
Yeah, that's the only brand I use, actually, so this is great.
I use the Google Chrome browser, and they have this browser plugin that's called EarthView. And what it does is that every time you open a new tab in your browser, it loads as a background image a really cool view from the Google Earth Maps. And so every time I open a new browser tab, I just see some beautiful either piece of scenery or an aerial shot of a city or just something that's fascinating and gorgeous. I've loved them, and now it allows you to download them and see the last several backgrounds that you've seen. And I have probably 50 or 60 of these images saved on my computer now. Sometimes I'm browsing the internet, and I just keep opening new tabs just to see what it's going to show me next. It tells you where in the world it is, and it might inspire you for your next Google flight, in fact, I think.
That's a great connection you just made, Steele.
Why, thank you.
Steele, I mean, while you were talking, I just added that app to my Chrome. I'm excited.
Dave, it's so great. It's made me happiest about using the internet in a long time. I just, all of a sudden, I'm opening a browser. I'm like, oh, yeah, nice. And usually you just open the browser and you're like, what am I searching for? But now I'm like, oh, yeah. And I often forget what I'm searching for. It's great.
That sounds like a productivity killer.
Yeah, but it's a happiness booster. So trade-offs.
That's good.
Well, there you go. We just hacked your life. The check from Google should be coming in, Eric. I'll split your half once it clears. Longtime listeners, you probably recognize this next segment. It's called Small Talk. For those of you who are new to the show, Small Talk essentially is where we share an anecdote, a story, something interesting we've heard or learned recently that you can use in your next awkward small talk conversation. Say you're at a party, you're talking to somebody new, you need something to impress them. We all have small talk contributions this week, and I think I wanted to hear from you first, Eric. What do you got for us in small talk?
My small talk contribution is that we are a mere 5 days and 15 hours away from the spacecraft New Horizons' closest approach to Pluto. This is going to be July 14th, 2015, is the moment when it finally comes upon this floating, distant ball of space ice rock that we know surprisingly little about. So, here's the background.
And Dave and I have discussed this. It still is a planet for us, no matter what the astronomers say. So, on this show, you're safe calling Pluto a planet.
Okay. I think I'm comfortable calling it a dwarf planet. I have some thoughts about it. But here's a little bit of information to help you with your small talk. This spacecraft was launched in 2006, 9 years ago.
Wow.
And it is one of the fastest spacecrafts ever shot out into space. They were trying to get to Pluto as quickly as they could. But think about that. The fastest they could get there is 9 years with a tiny battery-powered spacecraft. That's what it is now. So they swung it out by Jupiter. It took a big kick off of Jupiter's gravity to speed it up, and that was back in 2007. So it took a year to get to Jupiter. And it has taken another 8 years to get out to Pluto.
So here's my question. Like, if you're building one of these spacecraft, you're having to plan for it arriving at its destination like 10 years later. Right now, they're like, oh, I bet we wish we had the newest, fanciest camera on board. But you're kind of limited by whatever you could put on the...
That's right.
It's sort of like time travel combined with space travel.
That's right. But it's still far more sophisticated than the last thing that they shot out this far into the solar system. So a couple of other really fascinating details about this. According to Wikipedia, quote, the goal of the mission is to understand the formation of the Pluto system, the Kuiper Belt, and the transformation of the early solar system. The spacecraft will study the atmospheres, surfaces, interiors, and environments of Pluto and its moons. Did you know there are 5 moons of Pluto? This is a really recent piece of information that they've discovered.
So it's going to go past Pluto into Mel Kiper's belt?
It's going to keep on going past... past Pluto into... What did you call that?
Mel Kiper's belt? Mel Kiper Jr.? The guy that does the NFL draft? Isn't that what you just said?
He's an amateur astronomer as well, from what I understand.
I did not know that. That's a new piece. That's something for small talk, I guess.
Yeah, Mel Kiper's belt. That's the thing they're going to look at after Pluto.
Okay, and the last piece of fascinating information about this is that this spacecraft actually contains some ashes... Some of the actual human remains from Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered Pluto in 1930. And this will be...
sending him home, huh?
Yeah. I watched this video, which you can watch on the New York Times website, and this very hippie-looking astronomer was getting very kind of weepy about the poetry of sending Clyde to... And in fact, past and beyond Pluto. And this means that these will be the first human remains to leave the solar system.
Wow, and it's Clyde Tombaugh.
Tombaugh, who discovered Pluto.
That's very cool.
Do you think they, anticipated the potential danger of alien life getting a hold of human DNA? I mean, it could be a major problem for us.
That was not my first question. But maybe they've thought about this.
They could produce an army of Clyde Tombaugh cloned sex slaves,
And will Clyde come back and be upset that we no longer accept Pluto as a planet? Clyde's like, come on, guys.
I've been there. Nice. All right. Well, speaking of obsolete space instruments and human remains, I've got something. And it is... It takes place in the world of FIFA, or as Dave likes to call it, FIFA.
Yes, I prefer FIFA.
So, FIFA president Sepp Blatter, legendary 80-something-year-old Swiss, the most powerful man in world soccer, announced that he was going to resign as FIFA president, but of course has to take 6 months to do it for ridiculous reasons. But anyway, in the last week, he's been kind of walking back his whole resignation, testing the waters. And he gave an interview to a German newspaper in which he has probably the best quotes of the week. And this is what he says. He says, if somebody accuses me of being corrupt, I ask him whether he knows the meaning of that word. Whoever calls me corrupt will have to prove it. But nobody can prove that because I am not corrupt. Very tight, tight reasoning there.
Yes.
He says, I am open to correct or positive criticism. He's open to positive criticism. As long as you keep it positive, just keep the criticism coming.
Or correct.
Oh, correct criticism.
Correct or positive.
Yeah.
Which still, I think, leaves the door open for a significant amount of negative criticism.
Yeah, okay, that's good. I can use that to reconsider if I need to change in the future. But if anybody calls me corrupt because FIFA is corrupt, I can only shake my head. Everybody who says something like that should go to jail.
Wow.
I agree.
All of the people that have been doing illegal bribery stuff, no, of course they shouldn't go to jail. But if you claim that FIFA or that Sepp Blatter is correct, you go directly to jail because you just can't have that in a democracy.
Unless you actually know the definition of corrupt, then I think he's okay with it.
I suppose, yeah. If you know the definition, you're good. But then... I don't know how he got here, but he says, he's been under a lot of pressure, a lot of media accusations, and he says, my faith has given me strength during the last week. I'm a religious person, and pray, too. I own a golden cross that has been blessed by Pope Francis. I believe I will go to heaven one day, but I believe there is no hell. I disagree with the Pope on that. This is the man who runs world soccer. What is going on? Why is that relevant at all to the FIFA corruption scandal?
I think it shows how qualified he is to run world soccer. He has a better understanding of the afterlife than even the Pope does. Of course he can run world soccer.
Good point, Dave. I was thinking just prove that he was like much more like your senile grandfather than you ever supposed.
That sounds like negative criticism, and I won't accept that of Seb. I only will accept positive or correct criticism.
Yeah, that's sweet that he owns a golden cross that has been blessed by Pope Francis. Well, I guess he's all clean, guys.
Well, I want to know where he got that golden cross blessed by Pope Francis.
Was it part of the last World Cup bidding process?
Exactly.
So there's my small talk. If you come to a party and they don't know who Sepp Blatter is, you are in luck because you have a half an hour of just pure joy on your hands.
Well, this is less joyous. My small talk is more just, I just don't understand it. That's why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
I want you to take this to parties, talk to people, see if you can wrap your heads around it. So there's a guy, he's Swedish, goes by the handle of PewDiePie or PewDiePie. I'm not exactly sure which. There's a pie in there, trust me. Are you guys aware that video games are a popular thing in this culture, in the world?
I've heard this about video games. Yeah,
video games. So it's a thing. People like video games, right? Well, there's something that people really enjoy to do, which is they like to go to YouTube and watch someone else play video games.
It sounds like my childhood, frankly.
Yeah.
I never got to play.
They only had two controllers, and there was always two older kids in the neighborhood, so I just got to watch them play.
Right, exactly.
Well, then you guys understand. He puts videos on YouTube of him playing video games, talking in like a funny voice and going, "Oh no, I just got killed again." And this guy has like 40 million followers. He puts videos up all the time. He makes over $4 million a year just posting videos of him and his attractive girlfriend playing video games on YouTube. I don't understand.
Where does the money come from?
Ad revenues on YouTube. The number of views you get paid a certain percentage per view.
Wow.
So people just keep going. They want to see what he's going to do next. And hardcore gamers are kind of like, this guy's not that good at gaming. But everybody else just loves him. It's terrific. Bring it up with someone. See what they think.
Have you watched a considerable amount of this PewDiePie?
I tried to watch one video. I couldn't make it through it. It was like a 3-minute long one. After a minute and a half, I couldn't handle it anymore. I turned it off. I just can't understand.
Well, did you try another one?
Nope.
Maybe you just clicked on the wrong one.
No, I don't think so. I think that's what they're like.
No, after the minute and a half, I understood I never wanted to see another video from this young man again. But also, I kind of want to have his job.
Yeah, that is exciting.
But I will say, I read the article you shared, Dave, and the best part of it is that this guy and his girlfriend, they made the $4 million a year, and they chose to live in Brighton, England, of all the places. Yeah, we're just going to buy a house on a normal street in Brighton. I'm surprised they didn't get a vacation home in Skegness.
Maybe that's next on the docket. $4 million a year, you can afford a lot of mobile homes in Skegness.
Caravans, they call them, Dave.
Caravans, yes.
Wow, so we've got a lot for you there in small talk. We've got New Horizons, taking the corpse of a space explorer past Pluto. We've got Sepp Blatter and his Pope-blessed Golden Cross. And we have Pew Pew Die and his YouTube video game empire. How do you say it, Dave?
I didn't make it through the whole episode that I watched, so I don't know exactly how to say it.
Wow. Okay. Well, you're set for small talk. Well, we're really lucky today that we have Eric here in the studio with us, and we're going to have a very, very special segment of expert testimony in which we just ask Eric lots of questions about things that he's an expert in. The first thing that we want to know about Eric has to do with the state of residence. We want to know about Mississippi. I had a childhood friend from Mississippi. The most memorable thing about Strider was he would always invite you to go sleep over at his house, and then we would do it, and then once you did, he would just strip down to his underwear when it was time to go to bed. And he's like, "All right, everybody, to sleep in my bedroom, you got to be in your underwear," and then you'd go sleep on his bed in your underwear. And I would always have this real uncomfortable feeling that something terrible was going to happen to me when I fell asleep. And so what I used to do was take the top mattress and move it away from the wall about a foot, so that I would just sleep between the box spring and the wall and the top mattress, and I figured I would be safe. And so that's all I know about Mississippi.
Wow, that is Freudian.
Yeah, man, deeply revealing. So, first thing we want to ask you is, what would be an example of one awesome thing or one awesome story that could only take place or that you think could only happen in rural Mississippi?
Okay. Well, Mississippi is a beautiful, beautiful place that I knew very little about before moving there. And I've since tried to catch up in my knowledge of its history and its culture and its geography. But it really is this naturally beautiful place. It's a place where it rains all the time and it's hot all the time and the sun shines all the time. And it's a place where you kind of can't contain life there. Life just flourishes in all forms. And so it is intensely green most of the time. But I'm going to tell a story about a time when it wasn't intensely green, which was right around Christmas. And my wife's parents came to spend Christmas with us, and they decided they'd spend about a week in Starkville, Mississippi. And one of the things I can tell you about spending a week in Starkville, Mississippi is there isn't a lot to do. Everyone leaves town. The businesses literally close down, all 10 of them. So one of the days we decided to go out and visit a place called Waverly Plantation. So we drove out, we knew about where it was, we figured we'd find some signs that would direct us there. Nothing. I mean, there are no signs, there's nothing around. Finally, we just happened to stumble on it based on the address and this kind of map that we were using. And it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and it is an old plantation house that was built in the 1840s or 50s. Uh-huh. And it has this kind of wrought iron gate around it. And you walk up to the house, and there's nobody around, and you knock on the door, and it is creepy.
And is this meant to be like a tourist spot, or you just went out to somebody's house and knocked on the door?
Okay. This is a tourist destination.
Okay.
So we knocked on the door, and a guy answered, and it was a little bit like checking into the Bates Hotel. He was probably 35, glasses, very energetic in a way, but missing some really crucial social lubricant kind of small talk, for example. Small talk would have really helped him.
Sure.
Because he answered the door and he said, "Are you here for the tour?" And we said, "Yes." And he said, "That will be $10 a person." And as we were rummaging around trying to find $10 a person to give to him, he just began. He just said, "The magnolia tree behind you is the largest in the state." And I was still holding my $10 bill as I looked back awkwardly at this magnolia. And then he just kept going, pointing at things and saying what they were. And we continued walking through this house. And the house had been bought in the 60s by an antique collector who filled it with antiques from any period he wanted, not just antiques from the 1840s or 50s.
Classic antique collector move.
Right. And so we just heard the story of all of these antique pieces. About halfway through the tour, another family showed up, and he just brought them awkwardly into the tour and somehow communicated to them without actually taking a moment to say, "This is what we're doing," that he would finish the tour with them in it and then start at the beginning and cover all of the things. And when he answered the door, he took their money, and as they were getting their money out, he said, "The magnolia tree behind you is the largest in the state." And it was so creepy. So my wife is a sociologist, and she studies race, and she realized about halfway through that he would not have mentioned anything about the slaves on that plantation or the sharecroppers in the life of that plantation house after the end of slavery if she hadn't specifically asked about it. Just this effort to pretend like that whole part of it didn't exist. But this was a massive plantation.
Every antique in the place.
Every antique in the place.
But none of the labor.
But nothing about the life of that house in the antebellum period.
Wow.
Fascinating.
Did you get the feeling that he lived on that plantation, that he lived there? Or is this something he commutes to? What do you think?
I think he commutes. The guy who bought the place in the 60s and has been kind of slowly working to restore it to its former glory, which is a creepy thing, actually lives in an apartment attached to the side of the house. And we saw him walking very ghost-like. He's this very old man through the window outside at one point. And the guy who was giving the tour, it was clear, is a friend of the family in some respect.
Wow.
He never told us his first name. And he never told us how he was related to the family or the house.
Or even
anything.
Where the money was going to go, whether it was an authorized tour or just some dude that was there opening the door.
He had a fanny pack, so I trusted him immediately.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a clear sign of authority.
Right.
He's just playing his cards close to his chest. Yeah, I don't give out a first name unless I have to. Totally agree.
Welcome to the hospital. You're going to die. $10, please. So, Dave, you got any questions about Mississippi for Eric?
Oh, man. I got loads of questions about Mississippi. Thinking about questions about Mississippi was my favorite thing I did yesterday. So my first question is, Mississippi, it's routinely ranked kind of at the bottom of like a lot of social and economic issues in the United States. What's the deal? What's going on?
It is poor. It is just poor. It was the richest state in 1845, before the Civil War. It produced an incredible amount of cotton.
Wow.
An incredible amount of wealth came out of Mississippi. It is some of the most fertile land in the world. And after the Civil War, the economy collapsed. Bitter, bitter race relations and an absolute refusal to acknowledge the extent to which the entire economy of Mississippi is supported by the government. It kind of lends to this attitude of no social spending, very low taxes, and health outcomes are awful. And they know it, too. This is a fascinating thing about teaching in Mississippi, is that the students know that they are at the bottom of every educational category. They know the reputation that Mississippi has in the rest of the country. It's really interesting.
So is there still a pride in Mississippi? Do they see that and they're just like, we're still Mississippi, we're still great? Or are they kind of embarrassed by what's happening in their state?
I think it is an intense mixture of both of those things.
Sure.
I think Southern pride and Mississippi pride in particular is very, very strong. It is a culture of insiders versus outsiders. And there's a long history of suspicion to outsiders that has to do with the Civil War, has to do with Reconstruction in particular. And so anyone coming in and saying, we know how to help you, we know how to save you, we know how to do things better than you do, they're very resistant to that. Sure. But they're also very aware that they are the butt of many jokes in this country and that they are at the bottom of many of those lists.
One of the things I learned kind of recently was there's not really, what's the largest city in Mississippi? It's a pretty rural population.
It is a
very few urban centers, right?
It's a very rural population. It is a relatively low population. I think the total state population is somewhere around 3 million, maybe 4 at the most. And the biggest city is Jackson. And I think Jackson, Mississippi is probably about the size of Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
200,000, something like that. And maybe a little bit more if you take into account the surrounding metro areas. There's been certainly quite a bit of white flight with Jackson. But very, very few cities of any number outside of that. I think the next largest city is probably Biloxi. And then Meridian is probably about 100,000, if that. And Hattiesburg is a college town. Oxford is only 20 or 30,000 people. Starkville is 20 or 30,000 people. It's a state of rural communities and small towns.
So I want to address some positive things of Mississippi. The thing I would be most excited about would probably be fried foods, Southern food. What's your take on it? Are you enjoying lots of fried chicken while you're there, or what do you think?
That's an excellent question. So I think one of the only ways to avoid moving to Mississippi and gaining a whole bunch of weight is if you are vegetarian.
Yeah.
And it turns out that my wife and I are both vegetarian, although we have become increasingly pescatarian since we moved to Mississippi, because you can't go out to eat if you're vegetarian. They have either zero or maybe one vegetarian option, and frequently they will just forget that bacon is a meat, and bacon will be included in the vegetarian option. So it's been an interesting experience. I will say that fried okra is on almost every single menu that I have seen, and it's gross.
Oh, no. Can you take that
gross.
Back?
It's gross. No.
I like fried okra.
It's gross. But they fry everything. Hush puppies are great.
Is that a fried shoe, or what is a hush puppy?
I know. A hush puppy is like cornbread or something, right?
Yeah. Probably something like that.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of the hush puppy shoe brand.
Right, right. It's a delicacy, those fried shoes. So... and catfish. Catfish is the biggest economic driver in Mississippi right now.
Best dish that you've discovered?
Pass.
All right. Keeping it on a positive note, what's the next question, Dave?
I got nothing but positive questions here. So SEC football.
Yeah.
That's all I hear about. Do people really care that much about it? What's going on?
Yes. It was interesting moving from Madison to Starkville. I was asked if I was prepared for SEC football, and I said, well, I'm coming from the Big Ten. The stadium in Madison, Wisconsin holds about 90,000 people, and the stadium in Starkville, after renovations, only holds a little bit more than 60,000. So
you're like, I'm
ready.
I understand.
But it is a real thing in Mississippi. It is the second thing to going to church. It is church and SEC football. And I'm excited to tell you that I will have season tickets for this coming year for Mississippi State football.
You're a Bulldog season ticket holder?
Bulldog season ticket holder. It was exciting to be at Mississippi State when they were number one in the country last year.
Yeah. How's it looking for next year?
It's going to be another good season. We have our quarterback is coming back, Dak Prescott. He's a Tim Tebow kind of quarterback who can throw a little bit better than Tebow could.
Heisman candidate.
Yeah. Early
front runner. Is he Christian? Is he very Christian as well?
I can only imagine.
I think he's Baha'i,
but...
Dave, actually. The Baha'is are really popular now. Starkville.
I've never actually met him to ask him in person about his religious views.
Where he churches.
Okay.
Right.
So I have just a couple more questions.
Keep them coming.
So Alabama... We know they have To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
What does Mississippi have?
Yeah, I don't really have an answer to that question.
I do. Have you heard of a little author named John Grisham?
It's a trick question. I knew that was the answer.
A Time to Kill. Not only To Kill a Mockingbird, there is a Time to Kill.
John Grisham is probably the most famous alumnus of Mississippi State, and Mississippi State has a massive reading room in the library dedicated to the John Grisham collection. So all of his manuscripts are there, first edition, translated editions. It's a beautiful, light-controlled, humidity-controlled, temperature-controlled
reading room. Scholars and researchers are often uncovering the latest in John Grisham marginalia.
Yeah. I think he just came out with a new book.
Yeah, I've already read it. It's fantastic.
So we got John Grisham. Come on, Dave. You have a question that's a little less dumb?
I hope so. So
these are great.
Are there beaches in Mississippi? And part two, what is Mississippi going to do with the BP settlement money?
There are beaches in Mississippi down in Biloxi, Gulf Coast, Gulfport. I haven't been there since we moved to Mississippi, but I can tell you that this was an area devastated by Hurricane Katrina that hasn't really recovered yet, and the BP oil spill didn't help with anything. So I imagine that they'll probably put the money into building more casinos, which is one of the main attractions of Biloxi.
Yeah, in most of the John Grisham novels I've read, Biloxi casinos, that comes into play in almost all of them. So I understand that.
All right, another thing that you need to know about Eric as an expert was that before he came to graduate school, before I met him, he was a young executive for an up-and-coming clothing company, the now-defunct Stephen Barry. And most of our listeners probably know Stephen Barry as the longtime partner and vendor for Stefan Marbury's shoe line.
So I need to interrupt you there for a moment. Now, Dave, I know that you've asked pointedly about Starberries in the past on this program.
Yeah.
But Starberry was a very late addition to the Steven Berry's lineup. And in fact, the Starberry one debuted a full month after I left Steven Berry's. Only within, I think, a year and a half or so of Steven Berry's going under.
That's what happens you could when say you sign Stefan Marbury.
Starberry killed Steven Berry, although I think it was actually Steven Berry who probably killed Steven Berry's.
Well, Steven Berry's was famous for selling, like, high-end clothing, is what I would probably say. Just really deluxe menswear. And so the question that everybody wants to know was, who was the better dresser, Steve or Barry?
Both awful. I would probably give the prize of this terrible contest to Barry, because I don't want to give any prize to Steve. I don't want to speak badly of the man, but he was
We'll blur your voice. Okay. We'll do one of those witness protection things.
But he was not good at anything, and dressing was one of those things. So this was a fascinating operation, and at the time I had this sense that something was wrong. And I think it was partly that this was corporate culture. I was working in the corporate headquarters of Steven Berry's. And I also think that lots of things were wrong with this company. So their business model was fascinating. What they decided to do was hire a bunch of very recent college graduates who had degrees in the humanities, by and large, and no direction in life, who were willing to move to New York, who were very smart according to their metrics. And one of their metrics was, how well did you do on your SAT? I kid you not, I was asked that in my interview, and I really didn't remember. I was so flummoxed by that question.
As an 18-year-old, how did you do on a standardized test? That's what qualifies you to work for us.
Exactly. They wanted raw talent, and that was the thing that measured raw talent. And what they decided to do was bring in all of these young, well-educated, but largely directionless kids, fresh out of college, and put them to work with no experienced oversight or direction. And they said, run our company.
Sweet. And into the ground.
That's what we did. That's exactly what we did. At 22 years of age, I was the director of training for the entire company, which by the time I left included 227 stores, all of whom had several store managers and literally thousands of employees and so on and so forth. We flew these new store managers in to an elaborate training program that I wrote that lasted for 2 weeks at a pop. I mean, I had several people working for me. I reported directly to the director of store operations and then to Steve above him. So I knew Steve. It was fascinating. It was a fascinating experience.
Yeah.
So how did you rise so quickly? What got you that position? How'd that happen?
He had a chin piercing. I don't know. He's not wearing it right now, Dave, but I think that was pretty instrumental.
I had a really intense conversation with Steve about my facial piercing. I didn't wear it for a little while, but then the corporate culture was so laid back, and they wanted to reassure us that, no, you should wear our clothing, which were like T-shirts and jeans and flip-flops and stuff. And they weren't just any T-shirts. They were T-shirts that said really stupid things on them, like a picture of a turtle, and it said, shut the shell up. So,
man,
yeah.
I wish I had that T-shirt right now.
I miss it. I've owned it for years, and I miss it. So it was this really relaxed, really relaxed atmosphere, and I hadn't done very well in my first role in the company. For my first 3 months, I was in the marketing department, and I did not get along with the director of that department, a guy who I won't say his name, but he went to Cornell, and he let us know that he went to Cornell every 30 seconds. And
it's a great
he
school.
Had
Big Red.
Gorgeous. Ithaca. Gorgeous. Anyway, he had no idea what he was doing. We didn't get along, and I found myself in a very intense conversation with Steve, and he said to me, you have an earring in your chin. You have street cred. And I said, I'm not sure you know what that means. So I got transferred from the marketing department to store operations. I was put in charge of writing a training program, and I faked my way through it and faked my way to the top. I left to go to graduate school, and I was told at the time that it was a stupid decision, and it was the best decision I ever made.
Well, let's go back in time. We're moving gradually back in time, starting with the present in Mississippi, moving back through the Stephen Berry days. Before Stephen Berry, though, Eric, you were at Duke University, and everybody knows the Blue Devils for their basketball team. And they really divide opinion, I would say. I just saw that Christian Laettner documentary recently.
I won't watch it.
It was pretty interesting.
He's a Buffalo guy, too.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I did not know that until seeing that. But for you, you were there in between championships, as they say. Your favorite Duke player, and then the player that you can totally understand why everybody hates from your era?
So I'm going to answer those questions in reverse.
Okay.
The player I could totally understand why everybody hated was J.J. Redick. Now, I loved watching J.J. Redick play because he made a lot of three-pointers, and that was really exciting. He was also really frustrating to watch because he fell apart in clutch games. And when you depend on a single player to score 40 points in order to win, and then he doesn't score 40 points, you don't win. But when he read his poetry on ESPN the morning before a game against Maryland...
I missed that episode.
Oh, no. Oh, that was bad.
Was it about puka shells? Because he seems like the kind of guy that wore a puka shell necklace.
It was about the cosmic struggle he envisioned himself in between God and the devil.
And, over him and over his three-point shooting?
Yeah. And the prayers that he would recite on the free throw line.
Wow.
It was intense, and he wrote poetry, and it was awful poetry.
Second coming of Milton, it sounds like.
Almost.
You can't serve two masters. You got to choose one, Steele. Your threes are going in for Jesus, or they're going in for the devil.
He made his choice very clear.
Blue Devils.
I don't dislike J.J. Redick. I enjoyed watching him play. I'm happy that he's made himself a career in the NBA. He's done better, I think, than a lot of people expected.
Certainly
but I
better
totally,
than Jimmer, you know, who was my guy in college.
It's true. But I totally can understand why people didn't like J.J. Redick.
Sure.
My favorite player is probably a minor figure, Daniel Ewing. And I say Daniel Ewing because he was the only member of the Duke basketball team from my graduating class. And so I rooted for him. He was a very solid player throughout his career. He played briefly in the NBA, mostly a bench player, but a very strong, quiet kind of player.
Did he wear the Ewing shoes? Like, did he wear Patrick Ewing's signature shoes? Because that would have been a good career move.
No, I don't believe he did. Yeah.
Any relation to Patrick that you know of?
Not that I know of, no.
Anything else you wanted to ask Dave on the players you love and hate?
Sorry. Yeah, my main theory on JJ is people hate him because he goes by the name JJ. It just seems like a really poor choice. Does anybody know what his actual name is?
I don't know.
No.
And I've never considered that before, but you might be onto something.
I want to know a little bit more also about what the Cameron Arena is like. And the Cameron Crazies, I think, are famous. Did you ever camp out for tickets or do any of the kind of live in Coach K tent village or whatever it's called?
Yeah, I did. My freshman year, we camped out for the Maryland game. And it was 2 weeks of basically babysitting a tent.
2 weeks?
2 weeks. So you would have a group of about 10 people, 10 to 12 people, and someone would need to be in the tent at all times. That means at night, during class time. It was a big kind of organizational mess. It was fun. We got in a lot of arguments, and we ultimately decided not to do it again. But it was a good time. For later big games, because they only tent out for 2 games a year. It's always the Carolina
tent out.
Tent out.
Okay.
Set up those tents
and
in Krzyzewskiville.
That's
right.
What it's called? Okay.
So they only do it for 2 games a year. It's always the Carolina game. And then one other game, whatever the top billed ACC game is,
okay. That
will be the other game that they set up the tents for. And for other games, it's just a walk-up line. The sooner you get there, the sooner you get in. There are no tickets. They take as many people as will fit in there. So,
so
it's first come, first serve.
For the game, you don't have a ticket. You just show up
That's right. On
the game day at X time.
As soon as you want, and they swipe your card.
In the day.
Or the day before, depending on how big the game is.
So people sometimes are sleeping in the arena waiting for the game to start.
No, they sleep outside the arena. Can't sleep in the arena. Yes. It's just a line outside the arena. And for really big games, that line starts earlier. And that's all tenting is. Tenting is just a glorified, organized version of a line.
But if you're in the line, you can't hold spots for other people, can you? Or do people do that? Because I'm sure fistfights would break out over that.
It's actually well organized and well monitored. There are these coveted positions called line monitors who regulate everything. And so
they collect the milk money and do all this stuff.
I'm just ignoring you there, obviously. For some games, the more important games, at X time before the game, they will distribute wristbands. And it might be a day before the game. And so you line up right. And your wristband will have a number on it. And then 3 hours before the game, you have to come back and put yourself in order according to your wristband number.
And the line monitors, those are just the acknowledged coolest guys on campus, and that's just how they get that position.
It's all political. I always wanted to know
how
they got those positions. And I knew a couple of people who were line monitors, and I never knew how they got to
Coach
be
K's
line monitors.
Coach K's wife dispenses it as a political privilege.
Oh, don't you dare speak badly of Mickey.
No, this is praise.
Okay.
She pulls the strings on the line monitors.
I don't think she's quite so active in student politics.
So, Tent Village. Mm-hmm. You're there for a couple of weeks. Someone's there at all times?
Yes.
And you have to register the members of the tent? Or
yes.
Wow, this seems super complicated.
It's really complicated. It's an example of how quickly and how complexly many societies can develop within society. Basically, what happens is there's a moment in the very beginning of the semester where the line monitors say, now is the moment that you can register your tent. And you have to have everyone there, all of your student IDs, they take down your information, and the order in which you register, you get a number. You're assigned a tent number. And you put that tent number on the side of your tent, and that is the order in which you line up to go into the game on the day of the game. So if you were the first tent to register, then everyone in your tent goes into the game first. So when they say that every tent needs to have somebody in it at all times, the line monitors check. They have a random checks times during the day. They have their little air horn and they push the button to blow the siren, and you have to go and check in with your student ID and prove that you are there with your tent. It is very sophisticated.
Police state.
Sure.
So what if you miss one of the random checks? Your tent is just set on fire and you're out?
I think you get one miss over the course of 2 weeks or something. If you miss again, then you're bumped to the back of the tent line.
Wow.
You're sent to the end.
So how large is Cameron Indoor Arena? I mean, it's kind of intimate, right?
It's very small, very intimate. It only seats 8,900 people.
Wow.
Up until very recently, there was no air conditioning. The student section, I think, is about 1,200, and it's right on the court.
Yeah,
and
right.
You stand for the whole game. It is one of the most electric atmospheres I've ever experienced in my entire life. It's amazing. You walk in, and you just feel the energy and the excitement. It's
cool.
Great.
So how many games a year would you be able to go to as a student? It depends on how kind of dedicated you are.
That's exactly right. If you were willing to wait in line, then you could go to the games. For the student body is only about 6,000. So if there are about 1,200 seats, that means a full fifth of the student body can go to every game. Maybe a third to half the students don't care.
Sure.
And don't go to any of the games. And so you're really only competing with half of the student body to get in.
Huh.
And on any given night, a lot of students would have projects or
sure.
tests to study for, things like that. So for most games, you can get in.
That's
if
cool.
if you're willing to wait for an hour or two before the game, or 2 or 3 hours. So I went to almost every home game.
So moving back even further through sports futility, we had the title drought of the Duke Blue Devils.
That's right. Winners in 2015, though.
Yeah, that was a great, great game. I mean, conflicted loyalties as an undergrad Duke, grad school Wisconsin. You had to watch that game with divided heart.
It was, objectively speaking, the greatest thing that has ever happened in the history of sports. I couldn't lose. I was rooting ultimately for Duke, that's where your undergraduate school is where your loyalties ultimately lie, I think, unless you went to a terrible undergraduate sports school. I'd watched almost every Duke game this year. I'd watched a handful of Wisconsin games, and I certainly rooted for them against every other team. But when the game started, I took off my Wisconsin hat, I kept my Duke shirt on, and I knew who I was rooting for. It ended up the way I wanted it to.
Wow, that's a sweet story. We're going to cut that all from the end. No, <it's>, we got to take a little bit of time to talk about Buffalo, another place that you are an expert in.
Love it.
Born and raised. Born
Buffalo
and bred.
Love.
Buffalo love?
Buffalo love.
Is that
a
saying?
Yeah.
Can you explain for us, the first thing that everybody asks when they hear about Buffalo is Buffalo, 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 Buffalo.
Yes, I can explain. Do you want me to explain?
Yeah, what's that all about?
Well, you need to understand that Buffalo can be three different parts of speech. It can be the noun, which is the animal. It can be the little-known verb, which means to jostle or to rustle or
stampede or force
stampede,
somebody.
Buffaloed
into doing Buffalo. Something.
Exactly.
Yes.
And then there's the city, my hometown.
It could be an adjective, I guess, in that way. Huh?
In that way, you can have Buffalo from Buffalo.
Which would be a Buffalo Buffalo.
Which is a Buffalo Buffalo. And you have to know that these Buffalo Buffalo can themselves Buffalo other Buffalo from Buffalo.
Ah, I see.
Now, adding to the complexity, I should point out that the plural of Buffalo is Buffalo.
Oh, right? So there's more than one.
Right. So adding to the complexity is that the Buffalo from Buffalo who are Buffaloing other Buffalo from Buffalo themselves might be Buffaloed by other Buffalo Buffalo.
I see. Oh, it's so clear now.
So you have Buffalo Buffalo, Buffalo Buffalo Buffalo, Buffalo Buffalo Buffalo.
Oh, well, that makes great sense. Okay. Well, now that we've established that, what is exactly coming out of the buffalo's head on the Bills helmet? I've never understood that.
I don't know. I think it's supposed to be some kind of a glorified horn. But the most bizarre thing about the buffalo mascot and logo is that buffalo don't charge. This is not, buffalo are not aggressive animals. This is a very bizarre thing. And the buffalo mascot is Buffalo Bill, as in William Buffalo Bill Cody from the 19th century, who put on carnival shows, which we
and
can
had
talk
nothing
about.
To do with the and city or state of New York.
Nothing. He did. I looked this up. He did perform multiple times in the city of Buffalo, but not more than he did in other.
Because his nickname comes from the animal, not the place.
That's right.
So what is the relation between the place and the animal? Is that just Buffalo get its name from the animal?
I guess. And I don't know if there were originally buffalo in the area buffalo. That is now referred to
is
as Buffalo.
Buffalo also like an Italian place, like Buffalo Mozzarella? Isn't that the thing? So like,
I don't know.
I'm guessing Buffalo was like settled by Italians from the old country that came to New York State. This is just speculation. I'm sure it's well informed.
Mm-hmm.
Just throwing it out there.
Mm-hmm. But can you think of any other mascot?
That is a guy's first name?
Well, not even that is a guy's first name, but where the logo and the mascot has nothing to do with the name, or where the logo is a drastic misrepresentation of the behavior of the animal it is depicting.
Yeah, that's pretty good. There's several levels of confusion there.
Even pelicans are more vicious and more aggressive than buffalo.
Mm.
About the only thing buffalo do is stand in the road in Yellowstone when you're trying to drive by.
So, yeah, the mascot, the animal that's associated, is actually basically a confusion for the city.
That's right.
And the bill itself is not represented in any way because it's a person's name.
That's
right. So you have an odd situation there. Well, that's cool. I think that's that kind of a legacy of futility there that really well defines the sports franchise.
One of the really important things you need to know about being a Buffalo Bills fan is even though you can acknowledge the legacy of futility, you always believe that the next year is going to be the year. And I believe it. I am a believer. This year is the year of Rex Ryan. It is the year of Terry Peguglia owning.
Who's that?
The new owner. The new owner of the Bills.
Ralph Wilson 2.0.
Ralph Wilson died. The Bills aren't going anywhere. We have a Buffalo owner. He's going to keep them in Buffalo.
Wait, are you saying you're a believer in E.J. Manuel as well?
Right now, I am.
Hope springs eternal, Dave. Wow.
That's right. When he was demoted last year in favor of Kyle Orton, I was a big Kyle Orton fan. But right now, it looks like Matt Cassel is not performing up to speed, so I am an EJ fan.
The question that all of our listeners have been asking, Eric, we've had hundreds of letters about this, and they said, Eric, we know you're coming on the show. I don't know how they knew, but they knew. And they said, we want to know if you could invite any four Buffalo athletes to a dinner party, who would you pick? Who would you invite to your dinner party?
Great question.
Living or dead. They would come as living beings or as like ghosts, I guess.
Great question. And I think most people of my generation would do what I'm about to do, which is give an answer of players who were all on the 1991 Super Bowl team. Number one, top of the list for me, Steve Tasker.
Yes.
Just a great guy.
Top of my list, too. He does the play-by-play, right, for the Buffalo TV now?
Absolutely. And he is just... He's a hero. He's in the Hall of Fame, isn't he?
He should be. For special teams and for mullet wearing.
And just for being amazing. Just 5'10" of power.
Yeah.
Number two on the list, Jim Kelly. Jim Kelly is a Buffalo hero. He has really adopted the city. He still lives there. The city has adopted him. Talk about overcoming adversity in his life after football. Not only going through the fatal disease and then death of his son from a rare disorder, but also more recently surviving cancer himself. And he is just, he's an amazing, amazing guy. He gets 3 thumbs up for me.
I believe he's still, and he also still holds the world record for least charismatic starting quarterback in NFL history as well.
That may be true. I'd still love to have dinner with him.
He'd probably be able to tell you all about like international tax law too.
Number three, Andre Reed.
Oh.
Great receiver.
Oh, that's a good one.
And also great hair. Has a long history of some really great hair.
I once heard, I can't remember where this was, but somebody said, Andre Reed could catch a needle in a snowstorm. And I thought we remembered that. That stuck with me.
That's a weird saying. Hands. Yeah. It sounds like a kind of thing you don't want to catch in a snowstorm.
You really don't.
It's
you
like the thing you want to avoid.
Well.
And then the last, Bruce Smith.
Wow.
Just power. Just 6 foot, I don't know how tall he was. 6 foot
six
is
foot 14.
6'4". Yeah, 6'14", something
probably.
Like that.
He's huge.
Could kill a bear with his hands.
Did
I'm sure.
Kill a bear.
Probably.
Half of the bears, probably. Offensive linemen. A couple tackles.
That's true.
So my follow-up question is, one, what were you thinking when Thurman Thomas couldn't find his helmet? And two, is that why he's left off your list?
Pass.
My follow-up question is, what the hell, man? You wouldn't invite OJ to your dinner party? Talk about spicing things up.
I think OJ is a fascinating character and was a very good athlete, a great figure for Buffalo back in the 60s and 70s, but I don't need to have dinner with him.
Can you tell me about the Bills' relationship to the Isley Brothers hit Shout?
I don't understand where that started. But this is the version of the song that I know the best.
You sing it for us?
No.
Oh, okay.
But the lyrics have been changed. It includes phrases like, the Bills are happening now, they're on the move now, they're making it happen now. And when they play it in the stadium, everyone goes nuts for it. When I hear it at weddings, I usually sing the Bills version of it.
Oh, man, I bet that makes you real popular on the dance floor.
You have no idea.
Was the Destiny's Child song Bills, Bills, Bills really about football?
Yes.
Okay. So the other thing I noticed about the Bills, the last playoff appearance, I looked this up, was the Music City Miracle. I'm sorry.
It's called Home Run Throwback.
The Home Run Throwback.
The Home Run Throwback, yes.
Because it's not miraculous in Buffalo.
Not in any way. It's demonic. It's the opposite of a miracle.
But that was in 1999, I realized.
That's right.
Which means that the Buffalo Bills are the only NFL team not to have made the playoffs in the 21st century.
That's correct.
Any thoughts on what's been going on this century?
Well, I think it's because we no longer have Doug Flutie at quarterback. We have had, I looked this up, something like 14 or 15 starting quarterbacks since Jim Kelly retired.
Yeah.
We've had six or seven different coaches since Marv Levy retired. We have no consistency, no ability to build a program, and nobody wants to go to Buffalo. There are no athletes who are excited about moving to Buffalo, and I think a lot of that has to do with a total misconception of this glorious place to live. They think that it's a boring city.
Well, you know, we have a lot of NFL stars listening to the podcast, so go ahead and make a pitch, Eric.
It's a great city. There are great restaurants. There's great food. There's, you know, good nightlife. There are a couple of great colleges. It's a great place to raise a family. There's art, a surprising amount of art, architecture, theater, and music in Buffalo.
Goo Goo Dolls.
They are from Buffalo, that is right. The Albright Knox Art Museum is a top-notch art museum there. There's some good theater as well. So it's a great place to live. I'd go back. I'd love to go back.
And that's perfectly pitched to NFL stars. They're always asking us where the best local art museum is.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of NFL players on the show?
I mean, Melvin Gordon's a fan, obviously, okay. Since, you know, we go way back.
That's right.
Dave, you got anything else for our expert testimony? We've really grilled them for a long time here.
I don't think he has anything else left to give us. I think he's done a great job.
We've talked about my entire life. This is quite a bit.
Well, thanks for being our expert. We've really bled you dry. The next thing on our docket today, we're very excited to produce this. This is a relatively new segment, but this is called Off the Chain Authors. And the one part of your life we haven't really talked about, Eric, was graduate school and your professional career. You are a literary scholar.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm an assistant professor of English, and I study literature. More specifically, I study the literature of the 16th and 17th centuries in England.
I'm already super intrigued. 16th and 17th literature, you're coming right at me right here. This is my wheelhouse, so let's do this.
Awesome.
So tell us about an author from your field of study who is just off the chain.
Okay, so the two biggest authors from this period are Shakespeare and Milton. And if you are like Dave and this is your wheelhouse, then you probably know Christopher Marlowe, maybe Ben Jonson and Edmund Spencer, maybe John Donne if you're like Dave and you're a real expert.
And Ben Jonson was also, I mean, people know him as the fastest man in the world for a couple years stretch until the steroid ban, right?
Yeah.
He's a very talented individual. Very talented.
But the author that I want to suggest is off the chain and really worth paying more attention to is a guy named Thomas Nashe. And Thomas Nashe had this fascinating about 10-year career in the history of English letters where he kind of stormed onto the scene, took it over, and then burned out brilliantly and died, as any such figure should, in poverty and obscurity.
Wow.
So what Thomas Nashe did is Thomas Nashe really popularized an aggressive style of writing. And this was something that was very new and very interesting, but in a really popular book that he wrote called Pierce Penniless, His Supplication to the Devil.
Pierce Penniless. Is that the character's name?
So that is the character's name. It is the authorial persona. It would have been pronounced Purse Penniless. So it's spelled P-I-E-R-C-E.
But, you know, we're not pedantic.
But we don't say Purse Brosnan. And he said in this, to characterize his kind of new and aggressive style of writing, he says, quote, "I have terms, if I be vexed, laid and steep in aqua fortis and gunpowder that shall rattle through the skies and make an earthquake in a peasant's ears."
Can it drop bombs, basically.
Exactly. And what he did is he kind of lived up to his word. He was advertising himself to potential patrons, and he noticed that there was this guy who had brought Thomas Nashe up in print and said something bad about him. And he says about this guy named Richard Harvey, he said, "If I wanted to prove that I could rail at somebody. Here is something that I might say. Then he says directly to Richard Harvey, I have read over thy sheepish discourse called The Lamb of God and His Enemies. And this was something, by the way, that Nash had promised not to name explicitly only two pages earlier. He says, and I have entreated my patience to be good to thee whilst I read. But for all that I could do with myself, as I am sure I may do as much as another man, I could not refrain, but bequeath it to the privy, leaf by leaf, as I read it. Do you know what the privy is?
He's just tearing off pages and dropping them in the shitter.
It was so ugly, dorbellical, and lumpish.
Dorbellical?
Dorbellical. Like,
that's an adjective based on doorbell?
As far as I can tell, probably not, but I don't know what it's based on. Monstrous, monstrous, and palpable, not to be spoken of in a Christian congregation, thou hast skewed over the schoolmen, and of the froth of their folly made a dish of divinity brewis, which the dogs will not eat. This was a man who knew, Steele, a man who knew and appreciated alliteration, and he was aggressive with it.
He just burned folks.
Ugh. So,
and so basically, he's making friends everywhere he
goes.
Like.
So, as you might imagine, Nash felt...
Hang on a second, Dave. You got something to add here?
Yeah, it's going to be really good. From what I understand, Eminem has caught on to this guy. His next album, he's using this as his like Slim Shady kind of character. Pierce Penniless, he's in.
It sounds perfect. It's a real...
I'm really glad I interrupted you there for that. Thanks, Dave. Yeah.
So Nash had this ongoing feud with Richard Harvey's older brother, who is named Gabriel Harvey.
Okay.
And what you need to know about Gabriel Harvey is that he was probably the most important academic in England at the time. This was kind of like Eminem picking a fight with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Right? This kind of like self-made academic figure who is really trying to push himself into the public's consciousness and make a name for himself. And Nash and Harvey went after each other in print for years. This was a long-standing feud between the two of them. And for a couple of years, the only thing that Nash wrote were texts attacking Harvey. And the only thing that Harvey wrote were texts attacking Nash. It's fascinating.
So was it deeply personal, or did they like have personal animus towards each other, or was it agitated by their ideas or by the man, or was it partially like print controversy to sell books? Or I mean, how should we think about it?
So that's the last thing you said, a print controversy to sell books, is the way it's most commonly read by people like me and Dave who study this stuff for a living. And
smooth.
Thanks. So my argument about it is what they were actually talking about, even as it certainly was personal and became even more personal, but what they were actually talking about was this new style of writing that Nash was helping to popularize, this new style of writing that we now know as satire. And so Nash was arguing that satire is useful, and let me show you how it can be useful. Let me show you how it can be profitable, both to the person writing it, I can make money by writing satire, but also to the reading public, that I can entertain you and I can help to shape your morality. I can help to keep your behavior in check by mocking vice, by mocking less than virtuous behavior or hypocrisy or things like that. Gabriel Harvey, on the other hand, was very worried about what this new and explosive kind of writing might do to the Commonwealth, that it might destabilize things by leading to the very kind of controversy that Harvey himself was engaged in.
And his concern is like, if you accept satire as like an appropriate mode, then what's to stop you from satirizing things that shouldn't be satirized? Like the church, or like authority, or...
That's exactly right, Steele.
Okay.
And what happens when an unknown author decides to take this kind of power of regulating people's behavior upon himself? He's taking that power away from the magistrate, away from the government into his own hands and becomes a kind of figure of vengeance, a kind of vigilante type of figure.
I see.
It's very threatening. But the problem is that Gabriel Harvey himself couldn't help but engage in the exact same form of writing that he was trying to denounce. And this is a big part of what my dissertation is about and what I'm trying to write a book about. But I find this endlessly fascinating. But a few more things I want to put out there about Thomas Nashe, why we should be paying attention to him. One is he wrote what might be considered one of the earliest proto-novels. So a kind of fabulous fictional tale that follows a single character in prose through this fantastical story. It's called The Unfortunate Traveler. It's really awesome. And it's 100 years before Defoe and Robinson Crusoe and all these other things that 18th century scholars locate as Shandy. The beginning of the novel. Yeah. Exactly. It's even before Cervantes and Don Quixote. The other thing is that he popularized this type of writing called satire, which really became the dominant literary form of the 1590s. And in the late 1590s, he wrote a play, or according to him, started to write a play and then abandoned it, called The Isle of Dogs. And this play doesn't survive, but apparently it was so incendiary and so scathingly satirical. It attacked the figures of the court in such an abusive and abrupt and harsh manner that everyone associated it with it was put in prison immediately. All of the playhouses in London were shut down, and Nashe himself fled the city of London, probably never to return. Scandal.
Oh, man, I want to read that.
Scandal. And then, a mere 2 years later, on the 1st of June, 1599, the Archbishop of Canterbury released an edict declaring, quote, that all Nashe's books and Dr. Harvey's books be taken wheresoever they may be found, and that none of their books be printed ever hereafter, and that no satires or epigrams be printed hereafter.
Nashe, so they banned it from anywhere in England?
They banned all satire forever. That's an edict, by the way, that has never been either explained or revoked. Eventually, it stopped being enforced. But it's fascinating. Nobody knows that satire was banned in England in 1599 by the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dave knew that, of course.
Well, Dave's an expert.
So
I love 16th century satire. So, what comes to mind hearing all this from you guys is you're both kind of literary nerds in your own individual aspects. But hey, Eric, how do you end up being like, this is where I'm at, 16th and 17th century English literature? Like, it doesn't seem like something that you just kind of stumble upon, like, oh, this is it. Like, what, how does that happen?
This was something that I just kind of got interested in as an undergraduate. I took a class on Shakespeare that I really liked, and it made sense to me in a way I didn't expect, and I really got interested in it. And then I took another class on Shakespeare, and I got even more interested. And that second class was really the class where I started reading some literary criticism and started to think more in depth about questions and problems of related to literature. And I think you eventually just nerd out about something if nobody stops you. And that was the thing that I really nerded out about. And nobody has really stopped me. A lot of people have wondered why this. And I don't know. I love the history. I think that this particular period of literary history is so important for understanding our own historical moment. So many of the ideas that were being fleshed out on stage and being worked out are still ideas that we're grappling with, for better or for worse. But I really geeked out about it, and I still clearly really geek out about it.
Yeah, so your jumping off point is essentially Shakespeare, and you had a big enough interest that you kind of expanded to his peers and looked out. So now, when you're just reading for pleasure, are you reading modern works, or are you still kind of digging back in more ancient writings, or what are you doing?
You know, I found that I read less and less contemporary fiction. I recently got a Kindle, and I think that's helped me read for pleasure more. And, you know, I'm certainly still interested in contemporary fiction, but most of my day is spent reading and writing about 16th and 17th century literature. And at the end of a day of reading and writing, the idea of reading and writing for pleasure is less appetizing than it might be if I were doing something else with my day. So it's really, it's vacations are the times when I read for fun.
I just finished my degree in nursing. I'm a doctor of nursing, in case Steele didn't tell you, which he should have.
He did. Congratulations.
Come on, Steele. So it's interesting. I'm reading all day studying this stuff, but I love reading. But I didn't want to invest any more, I guess, intellectual effort in it. So I just read science fiction for the past, 3 years, and that worked for me.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, try that, Eric. You don't have to always be delving into words you don't understand. Just jump into outer space.
I don't understand most of the stuff because it's like engineering and science stuff, but I... 27 fulcrum per second. I don't know.
Is that fast?
The ring core. I don't see. That's what I'm saying. It's probably not even a thing. I don't even know.
Yeah.
Just a parrot. That's all I am. The other thing that I was going to mention, Dave, though, that you should know about Eric, I think, and this is maybe part of how I think about your interest, Eric, and that's just knowing you as a human. But I think part of the appeal of satire or of literature for you, I've noticed, is this belief that both that satire, it's super fun because it's really funny and it's. Can be really cynical, but it can also be super idealistic and very scathing. So there's the humorous side of it that appeals, but also satire is one of those spaces, I think, where we see and we actually have our belief that words have power or words do something become validated. And so on your arm, you've got a tattoo that just says words, words, words. And I think a lot of people, they're like, that's silly or that's funny, but like for me, that's like a belief in words or the power of words in a way that I think is a little uncommon, but if you look at satire, it's really well founded. It's borne out, right? Words are powerful.
That's exactly right. And this is one of the arguments that I'm trying to make about satire, that it's not inert, right? That our engagement with any literature is never one of inertia, that everything we encounter influences us in some way. But satire is kind of like everything else compacted into this more powerful nugget and is really working to persuade you in particular ways. At least this is the way that I'm trying to understand satire, is that it is actively working to do something to you. And so in order to understand satire, for me, I think we need to talk about what it is that satire does rather than this question of what satire is.
So like the definition of satire, you're saying, no, it's less important as the effects or the uses of satire.
That's right. So for me, if you want a definition of satire, for me, anything is satirical that satirizes. There's this verb that we have that we use that we kind of contain in the latent word, right? We constantly refer to this word satirizes, and yet somehow when it translates to literary scholars talking about satire, they avoid that word.
Is there a relationship between satire and like core values or deeply held beliefs? Like I imagine, like, does satire require either its target or its target audience to hold deep beliefs about something to be effectual? Like, could you imagine satire being a thing in a society of nihilists?
That's a great question. And the short answer is no, I don't think that satire would really be a thing in a society of nihilists unless someone came along and said that nihilism is a terrible idea and let me mock this idea of nihilism. One of the things that my research suggests is that satire doesn't exist in a vacuum. It doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out instead from these deeply polarized moments in cultural history when there is a very deep rift between two opposing ways of thinking about or looking at something. So right now, we are living through a moment in American history where our country is deeply divided about fundamental beliefs about the way government should work and ultimately about science, about guns, about abortion, about all of these different things. And those are the places, those antagonisms are the places where satire emerges, where someone else's viewpoint presents some kind of fundamental threat to the way that you see the world or the way you want the world to work. And one of the things that I found fascinating about working on satire is that I started working on it because of all the reasons that you said a minute ago, because it is funny in many of its instances, I suppose. It makes us laugh. Catch-22 is hilarious, and we know that this is satirical, right? Saturday Night Live, The Onion, Colbert Report, The Daily Show, these are all things that we laugh about. And I thought, what better thing to study than something that makes me laugh so much, something that I take so much pleasure from? It's cutting. It's also idealistic in a lot of respects, and so I could kind of really sink my teeth into that because I'm a little bit idealistic, I think. But I've come to trust satire less as I've worked on it. That guy I was talking about, Gabriel Harvey, who is really resisting this idea that satire is a good thing and was saying, no, satire may not be a good thing.
You're feeling sympathetic now?
I think he was really smart. I think he had a lot of things to say about the way once you introduce satire into a debate, it's a catalyst and it changes the debate. And a lot of times it changes the debate for the worse, because ridicule is this really powerful thing. It is all about laughing at something rather than taking it seriously. The whole point is to delegitimize someone else's claim to authority or to even a right to be a part of a conversation. So in other words, if we want to do something about gun laws in this country, right? The Onion may not be the best avenue to do it. The Onion has, if you look back through their publications, they have time after time of article that mocks the entire idea of gun rights. And they're hilarious if you agree that gun ownership is a bad idea, right? But what it doesn't do is promote any kind of reconciliation between these two sides. It introduces extreme language, and ultimately I think it can backfire too.
So would you think that all this political satire that's become so popular the past decade, so you're basically saying that's probably furthered the divide between people in our country?
I am saying that. I do think that's true.
It's interesting. Do you ever watch John Oliver, Eric?
I do. I'm not saying that I don't watch and enjoy the political satire that is being produced. And I think John Oliver is killing it. I think he is doing some really, really great work. And maybe he is making an argument that Nash would agree with about satire being profitable in some way.
Yeah, it's hilarious. I watch it almost every week. He puts like a 15-minute clip of his show on YouTube where he's just finding some different social problem and making fun of the issues in it. And he's trying to get you to kind of come to his side, and it's interesting. And every time at the end of watching, I'm like, oh yeah, John Oliver's right. But he just, every week he has a new one. I don't know if there's any like real effect to what he's doing, if he's just bringing up these things for a laugh one time and then we move on and everyone's like, oh, that's kind of funny. I don't know if there's any like end game or if he's driving towards anything or he's just doing satire, he's making money, and that's it.
See, I think John Oliver is very clear about his rhetorical goals. I think he explicitly says in every episode, this is the thing that needs to change. And in more cases than not, he gives you a website to go to do something.
That's
true.
So exactly right. He issues calls to action. Think about the net neutrality episode. Did you see that one?
I don't think I saw that one.
Well, he did about 15 minutes on the entire concept of net neutrality. He explained what it was. And at the end of the episode, he gave a website that was the FCC welcoming input from anybody about this idea of net neutrality. And the people who watch John Oliver's show shut down that website because so many people went to it. And I think it ultimately, maybe just in a small way, but it contributed to certainly, but I think it probably changed the shape of the conversation that the government was having about this idea.
Okay, well, let's talk Unchained Melodies. We thought we'd do a very special edition, since Eric's here, of songs, music of the American South, but of Mississippi in particular. And I was racking my brain thinking, what kind of music connections can I think of that pull out of Mississippi? And the first one for me is a musician that I've already played on the show before, but Mississippi John Hurt, my favorite Delta blues man. Love the guy. I'm not going to play anything by him today because I've already played him before, but look him up, Mississippi John Hurt. Just listen to everything he ever recorded. He's the best. The song I am going to play to start us off, though, is by the great Bob Dylan. And this is a song about Oxford, Mississippi, and it's partially about the desegregation of the University of Mississippi. James Meredith, the first African-American student to enroll at the University of Mississippi. It's called Oxford Town.
Oxford Town, everybody's got their heads bowed down. Sun don't shine above the ground, ain't going down to Oxford Town. Oxford Town, guns and clubs followed him down, all because his face was brown. Better get away from Oxford Town. Oxford Town, around the bend, come to the door, he couldn't get in, all because of the color of his skin. What do you think about that, my friend? My guess, son, we got met with a tear gas bomb. I don't even know why we come, going back where we come from.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like Bob Dylan. Great artist.
Thanks, Dave. You got something from Mississippi for us this week, Dave?
I do. I was actually actively researching music in Mississippi, and I came across a song title that immediately I knew you would enjoy. And let's just listen to it. This is by a band called The Weeks, Dear Bo Jackson. Just kind of a southern rock, weird voice. You know I like weird voices.
Man, that's the finest tribute to Bo Jackson I think I've ever heard in music perform, Dave.
That's great.
Awesome. All right, Eric, what are you contributing from the Mississippi legacy this week?
Well, I thought I would bring up at least two Delta blues artists. The first one is the name that you hear everywhere in Mississippi, Muddy Waters. Now, I am not trying to claim any kind of authority over the Delta blues. If anything, I'm just getting introduced to this myself. But I went to the Blues Museum in Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is in the Delta, and they have reconstructed Muddy Waters' shack, the house that he was born in the Delta Blues Museum. It's awesome.
Super cool.
This song is called I Can't Be Satisfied.
Well, I'm gone away to live. Won't be back no more. Going back down south, child, don't you wanna go? Well, when I'm trouble, I be all good mine. Well, babe, I just can't be satisfied, and I just can't keep on. Well, I feel like snapping. Pistol in your face. I'm gonna let some graveyard Lord be her resting place. Woman, I'm trouble. I be all wood mine. Well, babe, I can never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on.
The next one is from the other, well, one of the other legends from Mississippi, B.B. King,
yeah.
who just died a month and a half ago and was returned to Mississippi. He asked to be buried in Mississippi, which is really cool. So he's buried at the B.B. King Museum in Mississippi. B.B. is Beale Street Blues Boy, or just Blues Boy is what B.B. means. And this is 3 o'clock blues.
Now here it is, 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes. Oh, 3 o'clock in the morning, baby. Can't even close my eyes. Well, I can't find my baby. No, that I can't be satisfied.
Such a distinctive guitar sound. You just hear a B.B. King song and you just know it's him playing.
Yeah. It makes me want to listen to so much more.
I can't believe it. You know what B.B. stands for, but you don't know J.J. So, a disappointment.
All right, so I've got a good song that I think can follow that. One of the legendary Mississippi musicians, they're the Staple Singers. And it's a family group. Pop Staples was like the band leader for many years, and his daughter was named Mavis. And they sang a mix of like gospel, R&B, and blues kind of stuff. Mavis Staples put out a record a year or two ago that was, I think, Jeff Tweedy from Wilco had something to do with, and it became kind of a pretty big hit. But this is a great song called Down in Mississippi from her record We'll Never Turn Back.
Down in Mississippi, way down.
She's like the queen of Mississippi music for me.
I concur, Steele. But if you want the greatest song ever recorded regarding Mississippi, you're barking up the wrong tree there. Because there's only one. The song needs no introduction. As soon as you hear the cowbell, you'll know.
Yeah.
So still, it is odd that a band from New York could get straight to the heart of Mississippi, Long Island nonetheless, but they did it. I don't think we can fault them from being from New York. They understand Mississippi, and it's okay.
Great, great choice, Dave. Way to end us on an upbeat note for Unchained Melodies. Well, that's a little bit of an introduction to Mississippi. Do yourself a favor and just listen to lots of Delta Blues. You'll thank us for it. As always, we want to end on a little bit of book wisdom, and as you've heard, we have a very literate man on the show today. So, Eric, we would love to hear some book wisdom from you today.
Thank you, Steele. And what I'm going to share with you does not come from 16th or 17th century English literature. It doesn't come from...
You may be able to understand what they're saying. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not true.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't come from English literature at all, in fact. Instead, it comes from something that was a real highlight in the class that I taught this semester. And the class I taught this semester was a kind of great books class.
Cool.
Great books and great ideas. We read literature and philosophy and political science. And this class really went from about the Renaissance up through the present. So at the end of the semester, our last class was this really great exercise that I borrowed from a colleague of mine that he calls the echo chamber. Every student in the class has the opportunity to read aloud the passage that they thought was the most powerful passage that we read the entire semester. And we go around the room and they read it. And then we go around again and they explain why. So the first time through, there's no explanation. There's no even acknowledgement of where it's from. It's just reading the passage. And so what I thought I would do is read the passage that would have been my choice from the 12th aphorism of the third book of Friedrich Nietzsche's On the Genealogy of Morals. So he says in his very Nietzsche way, "From now on, my philosophical gentlemen, let us protect ourselves better from the dangerous old conceptual fantasy which posits a pure, willless, painless, timeless subject of cognition. Let's guard ourselves against the tentacles of such contradictory ideas as pure reason, absolute spirituality, knowledge in itself, those things which demand that we imagine an I which simply can't be imagined, an I without any direction at all, in which the active and interpretative forces are supposed to stop or be absent, the very things through which seeing first becomes seeing something. Hence, these things always demand from the eye something conceptually empty and absurd. The only seeing we have is seeing from a perspective. The only knowledge we have is knowledge from a perspective. The more emotional effects we allow to be expressed in words concerning something, the more eyes, different eyes, we know how to train on the same thing, the more complete our idea of this thing, our objectivity will be."
There is a passage there that says something about, like, the only seeing we have is seeing from a perspective. The only knowledge we have is knowledge from a perspective.
That's right.
That's the part that really echoed with me.
And it's something that the newest types of science have been reinforcing, this idea that you can't measure something except measuring it from a perspective. Hmm. For me, it is absolutely fundamental to the classes I want to teach that resist the idea of a universal perspective, that resist the idea that the way I see the world is the way that everyone else sees the world.
I think you could, you know, view this also from a social, maybe empathetic view, that you can't fully, you can't understand a person's experiences, you can't understand their trials, what they faced. You could use it to say you shouldn't really judge these people negatively. I don't know what a man has gone through to get to where he is, and it's so easy to see from my perspective what I think his troubles are, what I think his problems are, when I don't know what his perspective is.
That's what I always tell myself when I watch J.J. Redick play basketball.
Or listen to his poetry.
So we looked it up, Dave. His initials are Jonathan Clay, but I guess J.C. was already taken. So we went with J.J.
John Redick, that's fine. Yeah. Just go with that. You'd be much more like, huge mistake, JJ.
Well, it's been a delight. Thanks, Eric, for coming on, holding court on Mississippi, Buffalo, Duke basketball, and our good friend, Mr. Nash. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having this. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, wonderful.
off the chain. It's off the chain.
Everyone dies.
You know, Dave, I mean, I think Eric's right about the death thing, and I think that should be part of the hospital orientation.
That's how I'll start each morning from now on with a patient. I go, hey, I'm Dave, I'm your nurse today. Everybody dies, you're going to die. I'm not saying today, but it's possible. It could be today. You hit this button if you need me to come back in, okay? If you're dying, hit this button.